Chapter 76. We entertain a very distinguished guest at Kensington. Should any clue be found to the dark intrigues at the latter end of Queen Anne's time, or any historian be inclined to follow it, 'twill be discovered, I have little doubt, that not one of the great personages about the Queen had a defined scheme of policy, independent of that private and selfish interest which each was bent on pursuing. St. John was for St. John, and Harley for Oxford, and Marlborough for John Churchill, always, and according as they could get help from St. Germain's or Hanover, they sent over proffers of allegiance to the princes there, or betrayed one to the other. One cause, or one sovereign, was as good as another to them, so that they could hold the best place under him. And like Locket and Peacham, the Newgate chiefs in the Oaks opera, Mr. Gay wrote afterwards, had each in his hand documents, and proofs of treason which would hang the other, only he did not dare to use the weapon, for fear of that one which his neighbor also carried in his pocket. Think of the great Marlborough, the greatest subject in all the world, a conqueror of princes, that had marched victorious over Germany, Flanders, and France, that had given the law to sovereigns abroad, and been worshipped as a divinity at home, forced to sneak out of England his credit, honors, places, all taken from him, his friends in the army broke and ruined, and flying before Harley, as abject and powerless as a poor debtor before a bailiff with a writ, a paper, of which Harley got possession, and showing beyond doubt that the Duke was engaged with the Stuart family, was the weapon with which the treasurer drove Marlborough out of the kingdom. He fled to Antwerp, and began intriguing instantly on the other side, and came back to England, as all know, a Whig and a Hanoverian. Though the treasurer turned out of the army and office every man, military or civil, known to be the Duke's friend, and gave the vacant posts among the Tory party, he too was playing the double game between Hanover and St. Germain's, awaiting the expected catastrophe of the Queen's death, to be master of the state, and offer it to either family that should bribe him best, or that the nation should declare for. Whichever the king was, Harley's object was to reign over him, and to this end he supplanted the former famous favorite, decried the actions of the war which had made Marlborough's name illustrious, and disdained no more than the great fallen competitor of his, the meanest arts, flatteries, intimidations, that would secure his power. If the greatest satirist the world ever hath seen had writ against Harley, and not for him, what a history had he left behind of the last years of Queen Anne's reign! But Swift, that scorned all mankind, and himself not the least of all, had this merit of a faithful partisan, that he loved those chiefs who treated him well, and stuck by Harley bravely in his fall, as he gallantly had supported him in his better fortune. Incomparably more brilliant, more splendid, eloquent, accomplished than his rival, the great St. John could be as selfish as Oxford was, and could act the double part as skillfully as ambidextrous Churchill. He whose talk was always of liberty, no more shrunk from using persecution, and the pillory against his opponents, than if he had been at Lisbon and Grand Inquisitor. This lofty patriot was on his knees at Hanover and St. Germain's too. Notoriously of no religion, he toasted church and queen as boldly as the stupid Sacheverell, whom he used and laughed at, and to serve his turn, and to overthrow his enemy, he could intrigue, coax, bully, wheedle, fawn on the court favorite and creep up the back stair as silently as Oxford, who supplanted Marlborough, and whom he himself supplanted. The crash of my Lord Oxford happened at this very time whereat my history is now arrived. He was come to the very last days of his power, and the agent whom he employed to overthrow the conqueror of Blenheim was now engaged to upset the conqueror's conqueror, and hand over the staff of government to Bolingbroke, who had been panting to hold it. In expectation of the stroke that was now preparing, the Irish regiments in the French service were all brought round about Boulogne in Picardy, to pass over, if need were with the Duke of Berwick, the soldiers of France no longer, but subjects of James III of England and Ireland King. The fidelity of the great mass of the Scots, though a most active, resolute, and gallant Whig party, admirably and energetically ordered and disciplined, was known to be in Scotland too, was notoriously unshaken in their king. A very great body of Tory clergy, nobility, and gentry were public partisans of the exiled prince, and the indifference might be counted on to cry King George or King James, according as either should prevail. The Queen, especially in her latter days, inclined towards her own family. The Prince was lying actually in London, within a stone's cast of his sister's palace, the First Minister toppling to his fall, and so tottering, that the weakest push of a woman's finger would send him down. And as for Bolingbroke, his successor, we know on whose side his power, and his splendid eloquence would be on the day, when the Queen should appear openly before her council and say, "His, my lords, is my brother, here is my father's heir, and mine after me." During the whole of the previous year the Queen had had many and repeated fits of sickness, fever, and lethargy, and her death had been constantly looked for by all her attendants. The Elector of Hanover had wished to send his son, the Duke of Cambridge, to pay his court to his cousin the Queen, the Elector said, in truth, to be on the spot when death should close her career. Frightened perhaps to have such a memento mori under her royal eyes, Her Majesty had angrily forbidden the young prince's coming into England. Either she desired to keep the chances for her brother open yet, or the people about her did not wish to close with the Whig candidate till they could make terms with him. The quarrels of her ministers before her face at the council board, the pricks of conscience very likely, the importunities of her ministers, and constant turmoil and agitation round about her, had weakened and irritated the princess extremely. Her strength was giving way under these continual trials of her temper, and from day to day it was expected she must come to a speedy end of them. Just before Viscount Castlewood and his companion came from France, Her Majesty was taken ill. The St. Anthony's fire broke out on the royal legs. There was no hurry for the presentation of the young lord at court, or that person who should appear under his name. And my Lord Viscount's wound breaking out opportunely, he was kept conveniently in his chamber until such time as his physician would allow him to bend his knee before the Queen. At the commencement of July, that influential lady, with whom it has been mentioned that our party had relations, came frequently to visit a young friend, the maid of honor, at Kensington, and my Lord Viscount the realer supposititious, who was an invalid at Lady Castlewood's house. On the 27th day of July, the lady in question, who held the most intimate post about the Queen, came in her chair from the palace hard by, bringing to the little party in Kensington Square intelligence of the very highest importance. The final blow had been struck, and my Lord of Oxford and Mortimer was no longer treasurer. The staff was as yet given to no successor, though my Lord Bolingbroke would undoubtedly be the man. And now the time was come, the Queen's Abigail said. And now my Lord Castlewood ought to be presented to the sovereign. After that scene which Lord Castlewood witnessed and described to his cousin, who passed such a miserable night of mortification and jealousy as he thought over the transaction, no doubt the three persons who were set by nature as protectors over Beatrix, came to the same conclusion, that she must be removed from the presence of a man whose desires towards her were expressed only too clearly, and who was no more scrupulous in seeking to gratify them than his father had been before him. I suppose Esmond's mistress, her son, and the colonel himself, had been all secretly debating this matter in their minds, for when Frank broke out, in his blunt way, with, "I think Beatrix had best be anywhere but here," Lady Castlewood said. "Thank you, Frank, I have thought so too." And Mr. Esmond, though he only remarked that it was not for him to speak, showed plainly, by the delight on his countenance, how very agreeable that proposal was to him. "One sees that you think with us, Henry," says the Viscountess, With ever so little of sarcasm in her tone, Beatrix is best out of this house, whilst we have our guest in it, and as soon as this morning's business is done, she ought to quit London. What morning's business? Asked Colonel Esmond, not knowing what had been arranged, though in fact the stroke next in importance to that of bringing the prince, and of having him acknowledged by the queen, was now being performed at the very moment we three were conversing together. The court lady with whom our plan was concerted, and who was a chief agent in it, the court physician, and the Bishop of Rochester, who were the other two most active participators in our plan, had held many councils in our house at Kensington and elsewhere, as to the means best to be adopted for presenting our young adventurer to his sister the Queen. The simple and easy plan proposed by Colonel Esmond had been agreed to by all parties, which was that on some rather private day, when there were not many persons about the court, the prince should appear there as my Lord Castlewood, should be greeted by his sister-in-waiting, and led by that other lady into the closet of the queen. And according to Her Majesty's health or humor, and the circumstances that might arise during the interview, it was to be left to the discretion of those present at it, and to the prince himself, whether he should declare that it was the queen's own brother, or the brother of Beatrix Esmond, who kissed her royal hand. And this plan being determined on, we were all waiting in very much anxiety for the day and signal of execution. 2 mornings after that supper, it being the 27th day of July, the Bishop of Rochester breakfasting with Lady Castlewood and her family, and the meal scarce over, Dr. A's coach drove up to our house at Kensington, and the doctor appeared amongst the party there, enlivening a rather gloomy company, for the mother and daughter had had words in the morning in respect to the transactions of that supper, and other adventures perhaps, and on the day succeeding. Beatrix's haughty spirit brooked remonstrances from no superior, much less from her mother, the gentlest of creatures, whom the girl commanded rather than obeyed. And feeling she was wrong, and that by 1,000 coquetries which she could no more help exercising on every man that came near her than the sun can help shining on great and small, as he had provoked the prince's dangerous admiration, and allured him to the expression of it, she was only the more willful and imperious the more she felt her error. To this party, the prince being served with chocolate in his bedchamber, where he lay late, sleeping away the fumes of his wine, the doctor came, and by the urgent and startling nature of his news, dissipated instantly that private and minor unpleasantry under which the family of Castlewood was laboring. He asked for the guest. The guest was above in his own apartment. He bade Monsieur Baptiste go up to his master instantly, and requested that my Lord Viscount Castlewood would straightway put his uniform on, and come away in the doctor's coach now at the door. He then informed Madame Beatrix what her part of the comedy was to be. In half an hour, says he, Her Majesty and her favorite lady will take the air in the cedar walk behind the new banqueting house. Her Majesty will be drawn in a garden chair, Madame Beatrix Esmond and her brother, my Lord Viscount Castlewood, will be walking in the private garden, here is Lady Masham's key, and will come unawares upon the royal party. The man that draws the chair will retire, and leave the queen, the favorite, and the maid of honor and her brother together. Mistress Beatrix will present her brother, and then, my Lord Bishop will pray for the result of the interview, and his Scots clerk will say Amen. Quick, put on your hood, Madame Beatrix. Why doth not His Majesty come down? Such another chance may not present itself for months again. The prince was late and lazy, and indeed had all but lost that chance through his indolence. The queen was actually about to leave the garden, just when the party reached it. The doctor, the bishop, the maid of honor and her brother went off together in the physician's coach, and had been gone half an hour, when Colonel Esmond came to Kensington Square. The news of this errand, on which Beatrix was gone, of course for a moment put all thoughts of private jealousy out of Colonel Esmond's head. In half an hour more the coach returned. The bishop descended from it first, and gave his arm to Beatrix, who now came out. His lordship went back into the carriage again, and the maid of honor entered the house alone. We were all gazing at her from the upper window, trying to read from her countenance the result of the interview from which she had just come. She came into the drawing room in a great tremor and very pale. She asked for a glass of water as her mother went to meet her, and after drinking that and putting off her hood, she began to speak. "We may all hope for the best," says she. "It has cost the Queen a fit." Her Majesty was in her chair in the cedar walk, accompanied only by Lady, when we entered by the private wicket from the west side of the garden, and turned towards her, the doctor following us. They waited in a sidewalk hidden by the shrubs, as we advanced towards the chair. My heart throbbed, so I scarce could speak, but my prince whispered, "Courage, Beatrix," apostrophe, and marched on with a steady step. His face was a little flushed, but he was not afraid of the danger. He who fought so bravely at Malplaquet fears nothing. Esmond and Castlewood looked at each other at this compliment, neither liking the sound of it. "The prince uncovered," Beatrix continued, "and I saw the queen turning round to Lady Masham, as if asking who these two were. Her Majesty looked very pale and ill, and then flushed up. The favorite made us a signal to advance, and I went up, leading my prince by the hand, quite close to the chair. 'Your Majesty will give my Lord Viscount your hand to kiss,' apostrophe says her lady, and the queen put out her hand, which the prince kissed, kneeling on his knee, he who should kneel to no mortal man or woman. 'You have been long from England, my lord,' apostrophe says the queen. 'Why were you not here to give a home to your mother and sister?' Apostrophe, apostrophe, 'I am come, madam, to stay now, if the queen desires me,' apostrophe says the prince, with another low bow. 'You have taken a foreign wife, my lord, and a foreign religion. Was not that of England good enough for you?' Apostrophe, apostrophe, 'in returning to my father's church,' apostrophe says the prince, 'I do not love my mother the less, nor am I the less faithful servant of your majesty.' Apostrophe, apostrophe, 'here,' says Beatrix, 'the favorite gave me a little signal with her hand to fall back, which I did, though I died to hear what should pass, and whispered something to the queen, which made her majesty start, and utter one or two words in a hurried manner, looking towards the prince, and catching hold with her hand of the arm of her chair. He advanced still nearer towards it. He began to speak very rapidly. I caught the words, 'Father, blessing, forgiveness,' apostrophe, and then presently the prince fell on his knees, took from his breast a paper he had there, handed it to the queen, who, as soon as she saw it, flung up both her arms with a scream, and took away that hand nearest the prince, and which he endeavored to kiss. He went on speaking with great animation of gesture, now clasping his hands together on his heart, now opening them, as though to say, 'I am here, your brother, in your power.' Apostrophe, apostrophe, Lady Masham ran round on the other side of the chair, kneeling to, and speaking with great energy. She clasped the queen's hand on her side, and picked up the paper her majesty had let fall. The prince rose, and made a further speech, as though he would go, the favorite on the other hand urging her mistress, and then, running back to the prince, brought him back once more close to the chair. Again he knelt down, and took the queen's hand, which she did not withdraw, kissing it 100 times. My lady all the time, with sobs and supplications, speaking over the chair. This while the queen sat with a stupefied look, crumpling the paper with one hand, as my prince embraced the other, then of a sudden she uttered several piercing shrieks, and burst into a great fit of hysteric tears and laughter. 'Enough, enough, sir, for this time,' apostrophe, I heard Lady Masham say. And the chairman, who had withdrawn round the banqueting room, came back, alarmed by the cries. Quick, apostrophe says. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.